Hey guys, my name is Amy Coonan, and I'm your host for The Town Hall, Rubicon's first and only podcast where we share advice for techies, for earth lovers, and for penny pinchers. As much as I love the sound of my own voice, this broadcast is going to rely heavily on guests who are subject matter experts on everything, ranging from how to get your small business up and running, interviews with some of the brains behind your favorite apps, and even how to remove garbage from outer space. You never know who's going to pop up and join me next in studio, so make sure to subscribe to The Town Hall on iTunes to get our episodes downloaded directly. And if your boss is making you work through lunch or your commute is just too short and you miss something awesome, don't worry, we've got your back. You can check out our blog for recaps, reviews, and all things Town Hall. Hey everyone, and welcome to a very unique and special episode of The Town Hall. As you all know, normally I'd be joined either in the studio or via Skype by a sustainability influencer, you know, someone who's doing some great things for the environment, but I'm going to flip the script a bit today because Rubicon at its core is a young company. We're a startup, we're a tech company, and, you know, we have been categorized as a millennial company. And I think the oldest person on my team just turned 40, and I'm 28, and I'm on the older side of my coworkers, and that is a very hard pill to swallow. And one of the reasons why we started this podcast was to reach a younger audience and not only entertain, but educate the next generation of decision makers. We want to tell them really cool sustainability stories, and it's really important for us to engage our audience. The waste industry is obviously antiquated. It's a very old industry. And at Rubicon, we're trying to freshen things up with our tech and a hungry batch of both employees and leaders that fall into the millennial category. But how do you merge old with new? How do you have people who've been in this industry for 30 plus years managing kids straight out of college? How do you have two different coworkers? One is used to filing paper and the other one keeps everything on a cloud. And that's where my guest comes in. So welcome my good friend, Chris Tuff, the author of the incredibly insightful new book, The Millennial Whisperer. Chris, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks, Amy. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. This is awesome.
So let's jump in. We'll start very easy. How did you become the Millennial Whisperer? Like, what does that mean? And obviously, I've known you for a while, and we've worked together on a couple projects at my last gig, but walk everyone through your professional and personal timeline that took you all the way and that all of your experience that led up to writing the book.
Sure. And I'll try to keep it succinct, which isn't my specialty, as you probably know. So if I ramble, just kick me. But, for me, it was, grew up actually in Atlanta and ended up leaving Atlanta to go find my first job in Boston. And 64 job interviews, I came back with my tail between my legs, and I fell into a job interview at a place called Moxie Interactive. And at the time, there were 12 employees there. I found something different there. It was a cool vibe. It was that kind of what you'd think in a digital advertising firm in 2003. And I ended up settling in there and ended up being in almost every single role possible. And I was an account executive. I was a creative copywriter. And then where I found my kind of niche was in this kind of creative and media combination in the world of emerging media and what was Facebook in 2005. And because of that, I created this niche in Facebook and, got to work directly with Mark Zuckerberg and some of his first products back
then.
What
was that like?
He wasn't very talkative. We had one dinner together. And he didn't really say much. And I was like, wow, this is an interesting guy. But kind of what you'd think, what I expected in a way. I mean, at that point, it was only on 26 campuses. And, I remember thinking, I think this thing might do it. Maybe we finally found the MySpace killer. And sure enough, everything happened. It was actually kind of funny when, I talked to my team a lot about how your passions should be colliding with your professional career. And when that's happening is when your personal life and your professional life kind of blur lines. And in order to get my first department, which was emerging media at Moxie, I was told, okay, Chris, so we see this Facebook thing is starting to blow up, but there's this new thing called a viral video. And if you can get a viral video, then we will give you your own department around emerging media. This was before YouTube. And so I turned to, my bosses, Joel Lunenfeld and Chris Pinto, who the book is dedicated to because they were my first millennial whisperers because they let me do whatever the heck I wanted. And I said, all right, so what do I need? What needs to prove that I got that viral video? There are like a million views of a video. I was like, done. So I went, and at that time, I was about to get engaged to my wife. And so I called my buddy, who is a cameraman for The Real World, and I was like, listen, Brian, I need to set up this impromptu engagement as I'm running, because my wife is a professional soccer player, and I know that the only way that I can get her to be super surprised is if it's like on a run together. So we're going to be running down Valley Road at this point, and I want you hidden in a car with a wireless mic on, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to pretend at this telephone pole to sprain my ankle. I'm going to go from spraining my ankle to popping the question and blah, blah, blah. And we captured it all on film. Obviously, it was with the camcorder back then. And the result was something that the internet and, well, what started with our family when I sent them a link to ChristopherTuff.com. Once again, it was before YouTube. It was this kind of scale of emotion that the internet had never seen. So I sent it to my family and I was like, oh, wait, I got to get a million views of the video. I'll just use this one. So I started sending it out more people. And within 4 days, we had 7 million views. We were on Good Morning America, and we had basically checked the box for that viral video.
Can we still find it?
It's actually kind of hidden on my on my Facebook page. So if you're a friend of mine on Facebook, you can find it. My wife was getting a little annoyed that she was getting more recognition for this engagement video than she was for her whole professional soccer career. So I kind of decided to. And then I went on and I branded our wedding. We made double mint because we're both identical twins, my wife and I. So I did doublemintwedding.com. We were one of the first wedding websites, and it got us on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And at that point, my wife was like, this is ridiculous. I was like, no, we're just getting warmed up. And my daughter, my Finley, was even the youngest tweet ever when she was born. So I did baby_tough. That was in 2010. And I didn't tell anyone whether we didn't know if it was a male or female. And I just said, hello world. And then I used her finger to tap tweet. And so she was the youngest and might still be the youngest tweet ever. At that point, my wife was like, enough is enough. Like, but I use that as an example of like, you know, that you're in that passion zone
right.
when you truly are living and breathing this stuff. And I think the book has become that, right? I mean, everything I do is. This book is the closest to my head and heart that you can get because there's all these, that is my life. Some of it, I think you will find doesn't work at your organization, but most of it, I think you'll find it does, regardless of whether you're a big enterprise or a mom and pop shop. So, you know, my biggest challenge in writing this book was, Chris, can you solve for restaurants? Like that was like, it's like, listen, if you can solve, we get people quitting on the fly. We, you know, it's all of these kind of millennial stereotypes come to life. If you can solve for that, then you've definitely found something. And so I reached out to my friend Robbie Kukler, who you probably know,
yeah.
Owner of Fifth Group Restaurants, Echo and South City, to name a couple. And some of the stuff they're doing there is.
And Robbie is not a millennial. Let that
no,
be known.
No,
right.
But he is. A lot of the things he's doing are in line of what it is, what it takes to be an effective millennial leader or a millennial whisperer. And so, you know, what you'll find, I think, in the book and in a lot of the things that we're bringing to life here is that it's not that hard, but we just got to change the way that we're doing things, you know?
Right. So that's really the main point of the book is for how to evolve and change and grow your company using its greatest asset, which I believe are, you know, the young employees. So let's talk about some of the terms that people use to describe my R generation.
I'm right on the cusp.
Okay. I, you know,
1980.
I wrote in my notes R question mark. So my generation, you know, because the cover of the book is plastered in them, entitled, I'm seeing young, dumb, disrespectful, you know, needy. Why do you think that's become the perception of an entire generation? Like, how do we debunk the myth that I'm lazy and selfish and don't work?
So a couple of things. Anytime that you see a change in generation, you have a backlash. The same was true when the boomers took over, the Xers took over, and now we're seeing the same thing with the millennials. And so I think that that just needs to be acceptance. The other thing that I think is absolutely critical is look at the way that we were raised. And I talk about especially our parents with most of the millennials and some of the older ones especially. I think it's the largest gap in terms of a generational gap there's ever been. And that's because of a couple things. One, technology.
Right.
Right. So when we've adopted technology and how much part of our life it's become. But the other part is also just acceptance of different things and ways of life. And I feel like the rate of change is so quick, but like think about mental health. You know, a lot of our parents would never even think about talking about mental health in the workplace. Or, and my favorite chapter in the book is Managing Millennial Angst, because I think it's one of the
greatest things.
Oh, we'll
get there. I have a lot of questions
but,
about that.
So I think that there's this massive gap. And with that massive gap, what you realize is that a lot of our organizations are built on old school principles and values and cultures, and it's time to shift that stuff. And so once that shift starts to take place, and it's with small things that you start to shift the culture and the way that we rule as really leaders, that you start to see the biggest difference. And, you know, one of my favorite things is millennials aren't the problem. They just expose the problem. Like, that's an important point. Like, we've got to be, I, in everything I do, think that in the world that we live in, we need more empathy. We need to be ruling with more empathy. We need to be creating more connection. And I think we need to truly lead through example and empowerment.
I love that. So a lot of times on the show, I'll have, you know, my guest define a word. For example, I had this woman, she worked for an organization that was doing compostable products. And I had her define what zero waste meant to her. I've had someone define what eco-fashion means to them, because you hear all these buzzwords. And so I was thinking of something that I could have you define. And the one that I kept coming back to is culture, office culture, millennial culture. You know, how do you think we can build a culture that sets everyone up for success? Like, what is a culture to you? And more, you know, specifically, what's a successful culture look like?
So it's funny because we've gone through this. You know, I'm a partner of an advertising firm called 22 Squared. We've been around for almost 100 years. We rebranded as 12 years ago as 22 Squared, and we're about 350 employees and mostly millennial. And we set out to do this, and you'll see a lot of the examples of what we've done as an organization in the book. But when we were trying to identify our culture, what we realized, and really with the leadership of Richard Ward, our CEO, is that we were lacking kind of tent poles. And so he sought out to bring together these tent poles of what is our culture, which I think are different for every single company.
Right.
And that's where also I think purpose is a big piece. But the neatest thing was once we had those tent poles in, and an example of one of those tent poles is we're all leaders. Embracing change is another one. So once we had that in place, it was more about giving up control of the culture to the rest of the organization.
Right.
And we did that with what ended up just being actually a hashtag. It's one of the few examples of a hashtag being effective. And that's hashtag 22 culture, where right. You can't really put your finger on it, but it's all those things that you end up doing, whether it be the time that you share an awesome dinner with your work friends, to that epic moment of your buddy who is also working with you and killed it with his presentation. And if you look at the hashtag and how many people have adopted it, I mean, you'll see well over 4,000 posts from all parts of the organization that is kind of, each one is their attempt at defining that culture.
Yeah.
So I think the big, but like letting
but
go is so hard.
There's a difference between culture and just doing something cool as a company, you know, like having a foosball table
right.
and a keg. I remember I was with my old organization and we were at lunch one day at the Nook on Piedmont, and maybe like 40, 50 people in what looked like team shirts, like a red, an orange, a yellow, a blue, ran into the Nook and were having a scavenger hunt. And on the back, the shirts were 22 Squared, and there was a you guys were having a like citywide
yeah.
scavenger hunt, and those things are cool and important and those are benefits, but is that a culture? Is that what's going to attract people, or is that what's going to keep people?
I think that's what's going to keep people, but it's, you got to let them mold it. And
right.
that example is actually a great one. That's our media team. And I think a lot of people within organizations feel like they have to abide by the larger culture. And one of my big things to anyone coming in is define it further yourself, you
right.
know, create your kind of microculture within the culture. And, you know, the other thing that I talk a lot about is, you know, just throw away, don't worry about the kegs and the ping pong tables, or my friend I use as an example, so I apologize for this, but I'm not going to name the name. But she came to me and she was like, yes, so we created a cereal bar and we have over 30 cereals for everyone to choose from in the morning. But I still think that we're lacking culture. Why is that? And, you know, my response is quickly, it's a lot bigger than culture's a lot bigger than just a couple things that you throw at them. So, you know, I think what this book seeks to achieve is to further define those, but then also put it into tactical ways that we can kind of bring culture and let it blossom.
So obviously I want everyone to go out and buy the book, but I do want to talk, you know, about some more examples and some things that I've read. And I do want to hit on some of the tactical things, some of the advice and some of the issues. And the best way for me to prep for this was just think about my own experiences. And you and I have spoken about this before. But at my last job, I created so much anxiety for myself over communicating with higher ups. My boss, our mutual friend, Cody Hicks, a fantastic and really nice guy, he would email and message me things like, see me when you get in. Can you come into my office? Can we chat for a quick sec? And even though I knew that I had not done anything that would warrant a punishment or, you know, quote unquote, getting in trouble, I immediately picture packing up all of my stuff, telling my parents I got canned, crying in my car in the parking lot. And it got so bad, and my angst and my anxiety got so bad that I had to ask him, and, you know, thank goodness I felt comfortable enough to do this. When I'm not in trouble, can you put a smiley face at the end of your message? And we've talked about it, you know, like he had to put an emoji. And so I guess my question is like, why am I wired this way?
Yeah.
You know, how can I develop the confidence in myself to know that every time someone wants to talk to me in the office that isn't, you know, a coworker on the same level as me, I'm not going to get let go.
Yeah.
And I cannot, for the life of me, doesn't matter if I'm having a fantastic week and batting 1,000, like that's my, you know, my fight or flight. That's my natural instinct, is to think that everything's wrong. Why is that?
So my first thing that I have to say is, Amy, it's not your fault.
Thank you, Chris.
Unfortunately, sorry, Steve, it's your parents' fault. No, but I say that as a joke, but we've got to remember that the millennial generation is a product of parenting. And, you know, when we seek out this generation as employees, I think we expect something to turn up on our front doorstep that isn't the case. And, you know, you look at the way that I would throw myself in here too. We all were raised, and it was constantly going from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. I mean, you're going from your sports practice to your tutor, to your, to doing your homework, to SATs, to this, to the next. And then you're into the good school and you're in college, and you do the same sort of thing at college to try to get your great job. And then you're at that great job and people are questioning you why you don't know how to do certain things. And so it's because you've been put on this track. And so a lot of the product of what millennials, I think, are seeing as their weaknesses are a product of either the technology or the way that we're raised.
We talk a bit about the tech. Why does that make me so anxious all the time?
So, I mean, I think you're also used to instant gratification on the tech side, right? So anytime you're feeling down, you're going to post something that ends up getting the likes or the affirmation in almost real time. And, you know, you couple that with also, I think, an increased sensitivity to face-to-face interaction. And you have also, I'd say a third part of that is the fact that the only time people have given you feedback, anytime someone wants to talk to you in person, it's usually negative feedback. So you're like, oh, what did I do wrong?
Right. And I'm not the only one that feels
no, and I feel the same way. You know, like I feel one thing I emphasize to my team is every day is a performance review. So don't dread that performance review that's on a quarterly or yearly basis, because we should be giving real-time feedback. It's so essential to us getting better. But feedback doesn't always have to be something negative.
Right.
You know, and so a lot of the people that I work with can attest to this. It's about how you present it. And I present everything in the fact, like, let's talk about your strengths and how we can continue to grow those things along the way. Let's shoot those things that you're not good at. And there's plenty of things I'm not good at,
right,
you know? So I would say that dread is a product of all those things, but more than anything, I would throw it back on Cody and say, what types of interactions are you creating with Amy, person to person, that are positive?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you...
He was supposed to be here today. He can't. He can't defend himself.
We can't tell you why either.
Yeah. But I do find it very interesting. I get a lot of positive feedback and I still have that kind of dread. What are some of the ways that you present positive feedback to your employees? I know you guys do something really unique in your team meetings.
Yeah. So that's snaps. And they started kind of as a... Yeah, there we go.
I just learned how to snap in the last 2 years.
It's actually an impressive snap.
Thank you.
You know, so... Statuses. I remember growing up at Moxie, we would have a status report that we would have to fill out all the things that we were working on, and we'd pass it around the group via email, and everyone would fill it out before status, and then we'd go through it in status. And I thought to myself, there's got to be a better way. And as an experiment, I started one of our team meetings, you know, 20 or so of us, mostly millennials. And I was like, guys, we're going to do things a little bit differently. And we're going to go around and we're going to give each other snaps. And so if there's something that you want to, if you want to thank someone on the team for pitching in on a project, or if someone did a really good job this week, or if someone really pushed themselves, give that person snaps. And what ended up happening was pretty awesome. Like, so we ended up covering a lot of the stuff that we would otherwise cover with that kind of status sheet. And it set the stage of the meeting to be super upbeat and uplifting, and, you know, one where we were truly building each other up. And that was a year and a half ago that we first started that experiment. And every single status on a weekly basis, we spend between 25 and 45 minutes of our status doing snaps. And people laugh at me, especially some of these older kind of boomers, and they're like, you're kidding me.
Right.
You seriously do it that way? And it's like, just try it. And if at first you try and it doesn't work, then we got to work on your culture first, because
right.
You're not creating a place where I think millennials will truly thrive and want to seek out. But so that's one of my favorite tactical things where it's like, okay, leaving this podcast, you can go and try it with your team and see how it kind of changes things up.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that we've been talking about, is building that confidence to kind of combat that anxiety and that angst. And I was sitting with a coworker of mine in prep for this afternoon, and we were talking about all of the like different complexes that we've created for ourselves. Like, if only our bosses knew how crazy we get about things in our head and, you know, how they transpire and just, I mean, it's a rabbit hole. It can get really bad. And one of those things that we keep coming back to is workplace flexibility, you know, hours and working remote and stuff like that. Because like you said, I'm a product of, you know, Steve and Edie, and I watched my parents go to work and go to work early and then come home late and sometimes make sure that they left after their boss left and stuff like that. And I live an hour outside of Atlanta. My commute in the mornings are horrendous. My commutes in the afternoon are much worse. And so my boss allows me the flexibility and the freedom for, I think, my sanity and productivity to work remote a couple times a week, but I still feel so guilty. I mean, I'm still so in my head about it. I could be on a call with my boss, emailing back and forth, or a screen share with an agency, and still in my head and in my gut be like, I wonder if people think I'm really working.
Right.
I wonder, you know, like, I get so caught up in the little nuances of these amazing things that make Rubicon, like, for me, a fantastic place to work, the flexibility and the freedom and the creativity. But it gives me a pit. Look, I know you're not my therapist, but like...
No, this is getting really good.
I mean, why do... And my coworker feels the same way. And, you know, we know other people that feel the same way. We feel guilty for working remote. We feel guilty for not having an in-office presence, because that's not something that I think we grew up used to seeing.
Because I think the reason you feel that way is because it's not the norm. I mean,
right.
It's not the way that we're raised.
Don't you think it will one day be the norm?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, the best way I've heard it said is that people don't want work-life balance, because there's no such thing nowadays with technology. They just want work-life integration. And one of the things is, you know, I told, actually it was 6 years ago today, because I was going to our holiday party at our CEO's house, and we were on the way back, and my wife looked at me, because I am very much wired like a millennial. I mean, to the umph degree. My wife, Julie, goes, Chris, how have you been here now for almost, 5 years? I said, you know what, Julie, I think I figured it out. And it's that they've given me a long enough leash and enough freedom that I can really spread my wings and kind of fly. But they also know when to kind of reel me in to give me some of those things that are essential to me becoming a better leader. And, you know, that comes in training courses, and whether it be Myers-Briggs or Strength Finders or some of these other things that continue to push me to the next level, even today, I think it's that balance that we're all seeking. And so that work-life integration, I think, is so important. And one thing that our CEO, Richard, said to me was, Chris, for every rule, there's an exception. I'm like, oh, thank goodness. I hate rules, you know?
Right.
And I think that's what we're finally starting around the corner. But when it comes to like the flex work, it is the second most important thing, according to Deloitte's 2018 Millennial Survey.
What was the first?
Guess.
Money.
Yeah, money. Yeah. I mean, money and benefits. But right, like, the second one, and people are like, oh, those millennials, all they want is money. It's like, no. Well, listen, do you understand what they've been through in terms of when the recession hit them?
I mean, it says needy, spoiled,
totally,
entitled on the
but you gotta,
cover of the book.
You got to do a quick history lesson as to why number one is number one. And it's because right, a lot of these people are trying to get out of student debt that was caused by massive downturn in the market. But the second one is flexibility for work. But you know, when Facebook doesn't even have it right, that it's something that no one's going to get right. And right, so I would just encourage any organization to at least be open to it in some form or fashion, and to be careful before you start writing the rules. And maybe for the first time, we don't have rules, you know, right, like you got to let go a little bit.
Or a guide. Or
absolutely.
Something to, you know, help organize the things. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's smart. It's a good way. I mean, I just get so, feel so guilty. You know, and I think that is also because not everyone at Rubicon is a millennial. I mean, there's a lot, but there are people, like I said, and, you know, at the beginning of this, like, that have been in this industry for 30 plus years. I mean, they are the wealth of knowledge. They're incredible, but our industry is old. I mean, you know, if you think about it, humans have been making waste forever,
mm-hmm,
and have been picking it up the way that we're used to for at least, like, let me do the math, 168 years.
Right.
And we're always trying to like innovate and walk and talk, but sometimes it can feel that way. It can feel like we're, you know, 168 years old. So like, what advice do you have for an industry leader of an older industry that just can't or won't get with it? I mean, how do they start to get with it?
So I think it's one thing this is with everything. It's, you got to start small. And it's lots of small things that end up creating something big. And, you know, one thing I tell everyone is, you know, stop craving those champagne moments, or stop setting the bar too high for this thing to, you know, ruthlessly pursue, which you'll fail at. And instead, let's just concentrate on the three things that we're going to do tomorrow. And one way that I've set up the book is in that way. So what are the three small things that we can introduce where, even if it's got a 50% success rate, mm-hmm, we're going to start working our way to that in that direction. And so I think we forget that as human beings. You know, I think we forget that big changes are actually made up of lots of small things.
Yeah, that's what we say about environmental sustainability. It's
totally.
Like a diet, you know, small behaviors lead up to big results. So
absolutely.
What would you say the most common thing that people start with when they're trying to transition to something like this, or the first thing in the book that you think is the easiest, you know, lowest hanging fruit for someone to start doing?
So I think within organizations, we ask a lot of our leaders, and we ask them to be all things, all people. And instead we should look at pairing leaders. So I have this philosophy and hypothesis that there's order and then there's chaos, and you're either an order organization person, or you are a big kind of chaotic entrepreneurial type mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't ask someone to be both things. And if you actually look at any of the surveys or any of the data, what millennials are craving more than anything else is inspirational leadership. And what's funny about inspirational leadership is if you ask any leader, are you an inspirational leader? Most of them will say, absolutely. If you ask the people that are on their team, they will most likely have a different answer for you.
Right.
So, you know, knowing that that's probably the biggest thing within what's missing in our organizations. It's then how can we look at potentially pairing up teams or leaders to have an operations and tidiness and order, as well as someone that is inspirational and can kind of tell the big picture. And then, you know, you get into some of the other big things, transparency. What does transparency mean?
Right.
Everyone wants financial transparency. And not only that, but also show a little bit of vulnerability as a leader. That doesn't mean you have to cry every status or meeting, even though I do a lot, which is the product of just who I am and maybe being the father of two young girls. And well, we're not going to get into that. But, you know, vulnerability is just talking about when you're wrong. You know, when did you screw up? And I think you'll get a lot more credit for that. And then the last piece is don't be a hypocrite. You know,
yeah.
Do not, if you got to walk the talk. And I think a big thing that's missing in a lot of these things that we do is accountability. It's easy, and I talk about this as well, but turn your let's into by when. And if you look at a lot of the things, yeah, let's work on our culture, or let's do this, by when? You know, let's hold ourselves accountable to some of these things, and let's try to create numbers and metrics that show whether or not that thing was successful.
That's the best advice I've heard in a really long time. And before I get to the shameless plugging portion of the show, I want to play a quick game with you. I play this with all the guests. It's become a real fan favorite, and it just allows everyone to get to know you a little bit better and to kind of humanize this big thing that we're talking about today. I'm going to ask you 10 rapid fire questions, and I just want you to say the first thing that comes to your mind. Chris, edit yourself.
I will.
Okay?
I will.
Please, I do all the editing on the back end, and I really don't want to have to cut things out.
Okay.
Number one, what did you listen to on your way over to the studio today?
I was on the phone.
Number two, what's the best date spot in Atlanta?
Umi, for sure.
Who's the last person that you texted?
Cody.
What actor, dead or alive, would play you in the movie of your life?
I'm horrible with actors, but it would probably be someone that was mistaken as being gay a lot. I don't know which one. Who would that be? I don't know.
If you could rewatch one TV series for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
I would have to say, I love Chef's Table. I love the story arc of Chef's Table. And the story arc, why I love it so much, is that it kind of follows these lives of creatives, which I'm kind of a creative mind. And if you look at it, it's always chance and design of what creates what I say is a defining moment. And for any one of those chefs, their defining moment becoming a Michelin rated star, rated chef, is it varies tremendously, the percentage of chance and design. And it shows that you can only design.
The Christina Tosi one made me bawl like a baby.
So good.
Oh my God.
So good.
What is one piece of advice that you've heard in your career that's just really stuck with you?
I always tell everyone that in order to thrive at our organization, 22 Squared, you got to put the agency in front of yourself and your own ego. Always be willing to get your hands dirty and have a can-do attitude. And it's really that third one that in today's world, I think we need to choose light over darkness. And I think that we need a lot more of that kind of empathy and optimism. So if you can dream it, you can do it kind of thing.
What was the last concert that you saw?
Last concert was Jump Little Children.
Me too. At Terminal West?
No. Yeah. Well, we went to the later show.
Ooh. Who is your celebrity crush?
I'm horrible with celebrities. I don't know, probably some professional surfer that I follow on Instagram, but don't tell my wife.
What is your most used emoji?
A smiley face or a thumbs up.
And what does success mean to you?
Oh, that's a great one. So one of the biggest things that I got during my own journey, which started about 2 years ago, which I started the book with, is redefining what success meant. And so success for me used to be beating my older brothers at the game of life. They're very successful, whatever successful means or meant then, which is, you know, money and career and all that and things. And I redefined it to actually be gauged on a daily basis. And that's amount of energy put in and impact made. And so every night when my head hits my pillow, I ask myself, was I successful? Did I have the impact I wanted? And that's actually what the whole book's about, is I know I'm not going to make money off of this. I put a lot of money into it that I'm not going to make back. But all I want to do is have impact. And so every decision I make for the book is, will this increase the impact that this thing will have?
I love that. This was so fun and eye-opening and obviously like very therapeutic for me. But before I let you go, tell everyone where they can get the book, find you. I mean, you can even schedule Chris to like come do a culture audit or, you know, workshops at your company. Let's plug.
Absolutely. So if you go to themillennialwhisperer.com, that is two L's and two N's. A lot of people have a difficult time with millennial, including myself when I first started writing this book. But yeah, themillennialwhisperer.com. And you'll find most of the resources on there. One of the cool things that we have, if you pre-order your book on my website, is you'll get a free code to the Millennial Survey, which is actually, well, it's more of an assessment. So think Strength Finders, if you've ever taken a Strength Finders test, or couple that with kind of a 360 Zinger Folkman. And the product is really what this millennial assessment is. Who I worked with, one of my favorite professors from Vanderbilt who has a surveying company called G360. So if you buy it, you actually get that for free, which is like a $25 value. And it's for the book itself, it's $24.95. And you know, right now we are all about just kind of getting the demand and getting the pre-orders out there. So on there, you also find all the contact information. So hopefully that we should be going live with the new site today. So hopefully that'll be up and running.
You are the best. Thank you so much for carving time out of your Friday before the MLS Cup.
I'm
a big Atlanta United fan.
Go Atlanta.
Are you nervous?
I am so nervous. I was actually asking.
He's actually beat red for the first time in this whole interview.
Seriously, though, it is.
It's hot in here, too.
But it is going to be. I mean, the pressure that's on our shoulders to finally bring home a trophy for the city of Atlanta is a big one. So I feel confident enough to actually attend. So
love it. All right. MillennialWhisperer.com. Get your book. Share with your friends. Share with your family. There's something in there for everyone. We could all be a bit better, learn a bit more. And Chris, thanks for helping us get there.
Thanks, Amy.